Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is David Nicol. He's a retired professor of philosophy and sociology and a former resident of what is called Land Between the Lakes. He was a sixth generation on their farm there, which was a land grant from the Revolutionary War. TVA forced nearly 1,000 families out of the Land Between the Lakes project. He lives on his maternal grandparents' farm now, which is about 20 miles north of LBL, still on a peninsula between the Cumberland and the Tennessee rivers. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program. So a lot of people may not have heard of the Land Between the Lakes. Can you give us an introduction to it?
Yes. First of all, it's a peninsula. It's the largest inland peninsula in the United States. You got the Ohio River to the north and the Tennessee River on the west and the Cumberland River on the east. And Land Between the Lakes itself is about 40 miles long and averages about 8 miles wide. And it's kind of unique because the Cumberland and Tennessee rivers flow from the south to the north where they dump into the Ohio River. And it's interesting geologically, environmentally, every other way, because it's a transition zone between all the rest of the region surrounding. It's mostly hardwood forest now. They did plant some pines in there. Fish and Wildlife Service for erosion control back in the 30s and 40s. But other than that, it's mostly hardwood forest.
And is it, you said transition zone. Can you talk about the two or more transition from and to?
You actually have to the west of the Tennessee River is more open plains kind of thing. They called it barrens back in the day. When my ancestor Jeremiah Nicol came in there sometime in the 1780s, the Tennessee River was the far western boundary of the United States. The Jackson Purchase had not been added yet. The Jackson Purchase includes everything between the Tennessee River and the Mississippi River. And if you look at the old maps over on the Mississippi River, there's a little town there, a little settlement called New Madrid. We call it New Madrid today, but that was an old outpost from way back. They just had to come in and clear out land. There is inland between the lakes now, places called Nicol Branch, which is creek that starts on the spring where Jeremiah built his cabin. There's Nicol Cove over on the lake, which is where he landed when he came in. Everything at that time, everything between the Tennessee River and the Mississippi River was Chickasaw territory. The Shawnee were to the north up in Illinois, and the Cherokee were further south and to the west along the Tennessee River there. And that peninsula between those tribes was like a demilitarized zone. They came in there and hunted occasionally, but according to the archaeologists, there were no permanent native settlements there since back in the Woodlands and the Mississippian cultures, you know, a few thousand years ago. So when they came in there, there was nobody on this peninsula. It was just forest. And they just found a spring or someplace to get water and just sort of carved out places for farms. On the old maps from back in the 1790s, that stretch, that peninsula between the Cumberland and Tennessee rivers is marked on it, reserved for the North Carolina troops. That was where they were sending the veterans from the Revolutionary War out there and giving them land. And the reason for that was you had the French and the Spanish further west that were trying to claim the rest of the continent. You had the Chickasaw, the Cherokee, the Shawnee, and they were trying to get a new country going. So they wanted veterans out there on the frontier as the militia, basically. Now, it turns out there wasn't anybody to fight, but we just came in and settled it. And another part unique about this is down the center part of that peninsula is an area we called the Colons. And it was so rugged it's just almost convoluted, really steep hills and valleys, and so much iron ore on the surface even that you can't use a compass in that area because it'll pull the needle straight down to the ground. So nobody claimed that. It was just open territory, and we used it as like a commons. People would brand their cows, mark the hogs' ears, turn them in there when there were shortages, and then go herd them back up and get them out. And later on, that became, because of the iron ore, there were several iron furnaces started up in there, and they ran until about the Civil War. Federal government shut them down because the peninsula runs from the north down into the south, and they didn't want the south to be able to get access to that iron. So they shut down all the iron furnaces at that point. And all that just grew back up. And when I was a kid, still living over there, I knew men that would go in there, disappear out into the Colons, which was about 70,000 acres or so, and just stay in there for weeks at a time. Just go out there and hunt and just live out there in the woods.
So what is the current protected status to, well, actually, let's back up. Before we do that, in your bio, you mentioned the TVA. And do you want to talk just a little bit about that?
Yes, this is a long, everybody thinks they took over land with TVA in the Land Between the Lakes project. But that was actually the last in a long series of eminent domain. First of all, they started Fort Campbell down to the south, took a huge amount of land down there to make Fort Campbell, right on the Kentucky-Tennessee border. And then we didn't live on an island, but we lived on a peninsula. And, you know, people live on islands, learn to live within the limits of your resources or you can't stay there. And so from early on, we had some really serious conservation efforts going on trying to preserve the game, the wildlife, and the fields and everything. And my grandfather and some of his siblings and some of the other neighbors had themselves sworn in as unpaid game wardens to control the poaching and stuff that was going on in there. And that area of what was the Colons got taken. What was it? It was a New Deal program called the Resettlement Administration. Took that part of it and formed what became the first state wildlife refuge. And then they were coming in because we were the only ones. There's genetic testing now that shows that every white-tailed deer and every wild turkey in the state of Kentucky originated from there between the rivers. We had protected them, saved them, still had them. So they would come in, state wildlife people, and trap those and export them out to the other refuges they were starting around the state. And then in 1938, Franklin Roosevelt did an executive order, turned that whole thing into the first national wildlife refuge in the state of Kentucky. And it was called the Kentucky Woodlands Wildlife Refuge. And our grandfather and several others volunteered, worked on that, helped with that. And there's big waterfowl areas in there. I mean, lots of wildlife in that area. And then they built Kentucky Dam on the Tennessee River to form what they call Kentucky Lake. It's really a reservoir, not a lake. It's a big lake that moved a whole lot of people out of that area. And then in the early 60s, they built Barkley Dam on the Cumberland River, right across the peninsula from it. And they actually built a canal connecting the two reservoirs so they could increase the amount of storage capacity for the floodwaters and all. That canal is now the northern boundary of Land Between the Lakes. But they moved lots of people out for Barkley Lake. And it was brutal when they were doing this because, and TVA kept this going too. TVA came back through and then announced, we thought we were safe because the water couldn't come any higher, couldn't come from any other direction. And then TVA announced that they were going to do the Land Between the Lakes project. And initially, the original proposal was that that was going to be a national park. It was not going to be managed by TVA. It was going to be managed by a National Park Service. And they were going to leave most of the communities in place so that we could continue living there. But everything that had been in the Colons had been wildlife refuge and all. And the iron furnaces and all that would be the national park. And the reason they were doing this, and I went and interviewed the TVA planner who came up with the idea for all this, and he explained to me what had happened. And I found old newspaper articles about this. With all these federal projects, Fort Campbell, Kentucky Lake, Barker Lake, they had taken so much land out of the tax base. They had reduced the populations of the three counties, two in Kentucky and one in Tennessee, by over half. And the county governments were saying, something's got to be done because we're going to go broke. There's not enough people. We don't have enough tax base. We can't do this. So TVA, everybody thinks the TVA is an electric company. Their original mission was to be regional planners. They were to bring cultural and economic development to the Tennessee Valley. That was a region that was established in 1933. And he came up with this plan that if we get this national park there, that will increase tourism and stimulate the economy of the surrounding region, and that will offset the harm that's been done by all these other federal projects. And the people who live between the rivers and everybody in the surrounding area was really in favor of that. Thought this would be a great idea, have a national park here. And, you know, we're going to have this other revenue stream coming in now from all the tourism. And then TVA announced that they were taking over the project from the Park Service. And they were going to take everything. They were going to remove all the families, leave no in holdings whatsoever. So land between the lakes now is just over 170,000 acres, which compared to national forests like Shawnee and some of the others around here is not that big. But the difference is all those are scattered about in small patches. Land between the lakes is all one big block with the reservoirs there as the natural boundaries. It just really is unique in that way. You can start at the north end, and it got a trail. They call it the North-South Trail. Runs from the North Welcome Station all the way down to the South Welcome Station. And it's about 80 miles long or so. You can just hike the whole distance of it, and you're in the woods almost the whole way. But anyway, the way TVA did this, they just announced they were going to take everything. And then, of course, we were opposed to it. We'd been there for six generations. We didn't want them to just take our land. So they would send you a letter in the mail that said, your property is required for our project. And we have determined that this is the value. This is what it's worth. And we found out later they were basing what they called the offered price on one half the assessed tax rate. And you were given a date that you had to be gone by. And if you weren't gone by that date, they would show up with a bulldozer and dig a hole and push your house over into the hole and cover it up, just bury it. They did that to our churches. They did that to all of our outbuildings. They used every effort at their disposal to remove any sign that we ever lived there. The only thing that's left, and we fought to keep that, is there's over 250 cemeteries in what's now the line between the lakes. And we still maintain those and still use them. But there were several people I knew of that just said, look, I'm not going to fight you, but I'm not leaving. And federal marshals would show up and arrest them, put them in jail, and hold them there until the house was gone. And when they let you out of jail, you had nothing left. All their possessions, everything else was still in their house. We organized efforts. We tried everything we could think of to try to fight that. We protested it. But TVA was doing this massive public relations campaign to the outsiders saying, we're going to have over a million visitors a year coming in here wanting to spend money. There's going to be no commercial development, no commercial activity at all inside the land between the lakes. They're going to have to come back outside that peninsula to spend their money. So there's going to be campgrounds. There's going to be all the restaurants, gas stations, everything else out there. And you're about to get rich. And the only thing in the way is this bunch of backwards hillbillies living in that peninsula that don't know enough to leave. So it really was just this huge public relations campaign against us to get us out of there. And I knew lots of people that had their homes bulldozed. There were people had heart attacks and died in the middle of all this. People committed suicide. And you could not challenge, you could not take TVA to court to challenge the taking. All you could challenge was the offered price. And literally everyone, and you couldn't go to court for that. You went to a three-man TVA board. And everyone who went to that board to challenge the price had their price lowered. So very few people challenged that. And TVA used that to claim we were all willing sellers because we didn't challenge them. So TVA set this up. And the reason, part of the reason for this is TVA, with World War II and afterwards with the Cold War, got caught up in all their nuclear program, building dams, creating electricity and all this. And Red Wagner, who was the head of TVA at the time, made a statement that if TVA ever becomes just a power company, it will have lost its reason for existence. We need to get back to our basics of regional planning. How do we stimulate the economy, bring development to the region? And Land Between the Lakes was the project they came up with to do that. Now, jump ahead. They did some really innovative programs in there. Environmental education. They were doing good things after they got it set up. But then...
So wait, when was this?
They started taking property for the Land Between the Lakes project in 1964. They said it'd be a couple of years to get everybody out. The last six families were taken out by federal marshals in 1970. We fought them that long as hard as we could. But by that point, they had campgrounds. They had all kinds of environmental education programs, Boy Scout camps, school groups coming over. They were doing some good, interesting things, really working with the environmental part of it. TVA originally said, once they... you got the letter in the mail saying that they were going to take your property. You were not allowed to log anything, anything else, because we said, we're not going to log. We're going to let it turn into the eastern equivalent of a wilderness. And that's what they were trying to do originally. But then what happened, the old guard in TVA died off. And the new bunch that came in couldn't figure out what in the world TVA, this power company, was doing with Land Between the Lakes. It was a recreation area. Why would we want that? So they were given, the LBO management was given instruction from TVA headquarters in Knoxville. You either find this way, a way to make this place self-sustaining, or we're going to get rid of it. And they could have, because they, according to the 1933 TVA Act, TVA could use eminent domain under its own authority, finance its own projects. They didn't have to get cooperation from any other agency or permission from anybody. And they could use eminent domain for quote unquote demonstration projects. Land Between the Lakes was a demonstration for how you could use this eastern equivalent of wilderness to stimulate the economy. And the way the TVA planner explained it to me, it was going to be like a green magnet. He said, fewer and fewer people are going to have their own farms, their own access to the outdoors. They're going to want places for outdoor recreation. And if we allow this to turn more into a wilderness kind of area, that will attract people. And that's what's going to stimulate the economy. By the 1990s, the people managing Land Between the Lakes still thought it ought to be like that. But the officials in TVA didn't understand that at all. So they said, you've got to make this place self-sustaining. TVA is no longer going to finance this. And if they declared the demonstration to be over with, then they could just sell it. They could do anything they wanted to. But the head of TVA at that point was a guy named Craven Crowell. And he made an announcement that just befuddled everybody. Nobody could figure out what he's doing. He asked Congress to stop funding its non-power programs. We want no funding from Congress, no appropriations for non-power programs. Its main non-power program was Land Between the Lakes. It took us a while to figure this out, but with no funding coming from Congress, that removed any strings, any limits on what they could do at that place. They could have just declared it surplus property and sold it at that point. But the TVA planners, or LBL managers, came up with a proposal they called the Five Concepts. And this was in the 1990s, and they were having public comment periods on it and everything. And it was five proposals, five options for what to do with Land Between the Lakes. And concept one was basically remove all the campgrounds, move everything else, put some condominiums along the shoreline, and just have private developments and things in it. All the way up to concept five was going to have a hotel resort, a pro-level golf course, and a theme park. And the planner who came up with that was explaining to me, when a family goes on vacation, they go to Disneyland. You stay there for a few days, let the kids have fun, and then you go someplace else. If you've got the theme park, the golf courses, the hunting and the fishing, everything right there in one place, the whole family can come to Land Between the Lakes and spend their entire vacation right there. And he said, you don't understand, Land Between the Lakes can rival Disney World. And that was the plan they had. And we organized, that was the five concepts. We organized a group called Concept Zero. None of the above. And we fought them for several years on this. And finally, we got legislation passed in 1998 that said, if TVA ever fails to get at least $8 million funding to run Land Between the Lakes, it will automatically transfer to the Forest Service. And that's when it went to the U.S. Forest Service. So we went from TVA managing it and then deciding they didn't want it, didn't know what to do with it, to now we're in the U.S. Department of Agriculture and got the Forest Service come in and just logging the smithereens out of the place. We did have the protected areas in there. And this was a TVA program they did back in the 60s. When they first came in, they brought in biologists and they identified what they called biological study areas. And these were unique places in Land Between the Lakes, either because it was very nearly mature forest. It was all second growth, but a lot of it was old growth getting towards, you know, being really mature. There are also places where there were just out in the woods where there was a spring where you had hellbenders. We had Bryce's potato beans, lots of endangered species, threatened species in there. They identified those areas. And then TVA entered into the United Nations Man in the Biosphere program and declared those biosphere reserves. And they called them core areas. And when the Forest Service took over, came up with their management plan, this is one of the concessions we got, was for them to keep those core areas in place. And they're not supposed to do any management at all. And it's about 42,500 acres of core areas scattered about various places. Some of them big blocks, some of them very small. But they're not supposed to do any prescribed fires, no logging, nothing. It's like an ecological baseline that when the Forest Service claims we're going to log for forest health, you've got something to compare it with and say, did you actually improve the health of this forest? Or is it healthier over there where it was left alone? And a lot of those trees, a lot of that area had not been logged since probably back in the 50s. And it's still there. The forest there, the canopy is moving over. So it's wide open forest underneath, easy to walk through. But the Forest Service does not publicize this. The general public doesn't know they're there. It's hard to find a map showing where they are. There's no trails into them. And instead, they're saying what the public wants is early successional habitat for better hunting. They want to, they claim they were going to convert, except for the core areas, most of Land Between the Lakes into prairies. You're going to start burning it off on a regular basis and have it be like a prairie habitat. because they claimed that was what was originally there. But if you look at all the early biological studies, that was not at all what was there. It was a very old growth forest. There's some pictures from when they were building Kentucky Dam and they were clearing the bottom. There were virgin forests down there in that river bottom. And TVA bulldozed all that down and burned it, piled it up and burned it to clear off the area for the reservoir to put it in. And there's pictures of some of the guys out there standing on the stumps next to the trees laying on their side. And the trees laying on their side are over the heads, taller than the men standing on the stumps. There were huge tupelos, oaks, cherry, walnuts, everything else in there. And they bulldozed all that, piled it up and burned it. And the Corps of Engineers did the same thing on the Cumberland when they did that one, just piled it all up and burned it. Bulldozed down all the buildings, everything else. When TVA created Land Between the Lakes, they took the wildlife refuge. They kicked the Fish and Wildlife Service over and just took her over the whole thing. And then when the Forest Service came in, they've been logging and burning everything they can. And we're still fighting them on that. And one of my main pushes is to make sure those quarries stay protected. I have tried to get into every one of those and to try to find out what was it about this spot that the early biologists determined was so unique that it needed to be protected. And sometimes you can figure that out. Sometimes it just looks like really big trees scattered about and you don't know what it was, but those areas are protected. We had shut down, got a moratorium on the logging with the Forest Service because I got several local county judges involved in this because I went to them and said, how much is your county's economy based on tourism from Land Between the Lakes? They said, well, it used to be largely based on it, except the tourism's declining and we can't figure out why. So I would take them over there and take them to one of these quarries and walk them through that and then take them to one of the areas where they had just logged or where they were logging. I said, now, if you were coming over here with your family to hike, to picnic, anything else, which one would you want to go to? And so we started calling public meetings, and we would have sometimes 200 or 300 people show up at these meetings and just shout down the Forest Service. We did a convoy, started at the North Welcome Station, and drove down through some of the quarries that have roads going through them, and then went into the areas where they were logging and burning, just so people could see it. And we had it was well over 300 vehicles in this convoy. Forest Service didn't show up. They didn't come to that one at all. But they did agree to back off of the logging. And we just got a new manager from the Forest Service who is claiming he's going to start back up the logging projects and the burning again. So we're going to be right back in this fight trying to protect it. And one of the things, I'm the president of what's called Between the Rivers, Inc., which is the former residence. It was over 50 years ago they ran us out of there, and we're still fighting to protect that place. They took it from us in order to try to protect it, and now we're trying to protect it from them. And we still meet on a regular basis, have monthly meetings. We have, during the winter when the ticks are not out, we get together every Saturday and go clean cemeteries. There was only one church left. They bulldozed all the rest of them. And it was over 2 miles from the nearest road because the road you used to get to it was under the lake now. And we built a road back into that place and completely restored that church. Forest Service threatened to arrest us for working on that. And we got some of our state and county politicians to contact them and said, look, the crew's going to be over there Saturday working on that church. And we're going to be there with them, and we're going to have reporters with us. And if you're going to arrest them, you've got to arrest us too. And they backed off and said, okay, you can go ahead. And so we've completely restored that church. And the agreement we've signed with them now for us to do all the maintenance on it, maintain it, they can never use that for tourism purposes. They can't have tours going to it. It doesn't show up on any maps. Anybody that finds it by accident. You just drive out, 2 miles down this road through the woods And all of a sudden, here's this church standing out there. Matter of fact, they have started right now doing, on Saturdays, the Forest Service does van tours, and it costs like $25, $30 a piece to ride in a van, and they drive you down the back roads and things. And I just got in touch with them, found out they were doing this, and said, you cannot take those tours back to St. Stephen's Church. That is not supposed to be used for tourism in any way. There's not much left there, but what there is, we're trying to protect.
So in your bio, and then also several times in this interview, you have referenced that your family and that this community has been on the land for generations. Given the sort of hypermobility of modern society, can you comment a little bit on what it's like to live in place, my great-grandmother grew up on the Nebraska prairie, and now I live in California, and I've lived in Colorado and Nevada and Idaho and Washington. And so what is it like for a family to stay in place for that long?
One of the comments I hear all the time is there was never a for sale sign for the rivers. Families just stayed in place. And each generation would either live in the house. Talking about six generations of people being born and having died in that house. Sometimes they'd go over to the corner of the farm, different corner, and build a house over there somewhere for other generations. But I grew up with fifth and sixth generation, sometimes seventh generation neighbors. My brothers and I would just go out and wander. My mother would tell us in the morning, get out of the house, and I don't want to see you back here till supper time. And we'd just go out and wander the woods, follow creeks, and nobody worried about it because if you got hungry, thirsty, anything else, we knew where all the houses were and you knew everybody lived in them. And if you showed up, they'd feed you, give you something to drink, give you a ride back home, whatever you needed. When the Forest Service first came in, they had the first ever full-time archaeologist at Land Between the Lakes. And I went to meet with him to tell him, look, we'll work with you any way we can on this. And he said, I don't need your help. He said, I'm a professional. I don't need help from amateurs. I said, look, we were here since the late 1780s. We know where everything is here. We know, right? We can help you out with this. He said, how many generations do you stay in? I said, six. He said, you know, that looks like a real lack of ambition to me. I don't think people have any clue what kind of sacrifices you make to keep a place in the family for that long. You do a lot of work and sacrifice a lot, do without a lot of things, to be able to keep that land in the family for that long. And this is one of the things, German terms for this, Gemeinschaft, Gesellschaft. Homes in the suburbs don't get passed down across generations. It's a real estate investment. If you go talk to a farmer on a family farm about his farm being real estate, he's going to be offended. I've known people who committed suicide because they lost the family farm. It means that much. And then for them to come in there and just rip us out of that it was a devastating time. When I was a kid, I was 10 years old when they ran us out. And I can remember going to meetings. It's like weekly meetings. We'd get together and try to come up with plans. What can we do? How do we stop this? and everybody sitting crying. Just, I mean, it was desperate times. We found out that they were basing their offered price on the assessed tax rate, 1.5 assessed tax rate. So we figured out they were having to go look at the tax records. So we had people, we would take turns going over there every morning to the courthouse. It was outside between the rivers, been the county courthouse. And the clerk there was friendly to us and would hand us all the tax records. And we'd sit on them. You'd sit there and hold those records all day long so that TVA couldn't get access to them. They finally went to federal court and stopped us from doing that. People started swapping up parcels of land. I'll trade you a 10-foot square here for 10-foot square place on yours, and trying to get the land records so messed up and so confused that they could never straighten it out. And they went to federal court and made us stop doing that. On what had been the wildlife refuge that we used as a commons, people herded their cows and stuff in it, hunted on it. I mean, it's just what we'd always done. They started impounding people's cattle if they'd catch them in that area. And I mean, this is why we're still living there. The local constable arrested the federal officials that impounded the cattle for theft. And it went to the county court, and the county judge was threatening to throw the people in jail if they didn't pay for the cattle or the hogs, whatever it was they had. And they went to federal court and got that thrown in. Said the local counties didn't have jurisdiction because it was federal property. I mean, you don't just walk away from something like that. And we had communities. We had, you know, the biggest community between the rivers was a place called Golden Pond. And in its heyday, it had a population of maybe 300 people. And none of the communities ever had any kind of local government. There was no mayor, no city council, nothing like that. When decisions needed to be made, you would have a meeting at the local school. By the way, we had two schools in my neighborhood, Yale and Harvard. So we had people talk about, yeah, they graduated from both Yale and Harvard before they ever graduated from high school. Just, but we'd have meetings at school and just talk about it, figure out what we were going to do. And nobody had any kind of formal authority at all. It's just everybody knew everybody. Everybody knew who was respectable, who was respected, knew who was trustworthy, who was good at what. We maintained, the farmers maintained all of our own roads. We had our own schools over there with our own teachers. And I don't know how many people have been to a school where they served deer meat and rabbit in the cafeteria, but we did. The local community was supplying the school with the food to feed the kids. And we finally got a bus over there to drive, because the only way in and out, until they built the dams, built bridges at that point, the only way in and out of there was by ferry. You'd have to take a ferry across. And the ferry operator knew everybody that lived between the rivers. And as he came towards shore, if there was anybody on the ferry that he didn't know, that he thought looked suspicious, he'd start ringing his bell. And every farm had a bell, you know, a dinner bell. We used them to communicate with and call meetings, you know, alert people for his problem, anything like that. Everybody would hear that bell and start ringing their bell. And before they ever set foot on the peninsula, we knew there were outsiders there. So I guess the federal government came in and they thought these people are just so backwards and clannish. And the school bus driver had to have a surgery and was going to be out for about a week. And so they called a meeting at the school and trying to figure out how we're going to get all the kids to school. And somebody came up with an idea. So one of the guys that rode the school bus was a 15-year-old. Big strapping farm kid, been driving farm trucks and tractors for years. We'll just have him drive the bus. 15-year-old, drove the bus around, picked up all the kids, took them to school, and then at the end of the day, we'd drive them all back home. That would have never occurred to people outside. But to us, it was an obvious solution. It worked good.
So one of the, we have about 6 or 7 minutes left, and can you talk about what's going on currently with efforts to protect it?
Yes. When we got the LBO Protection Act passed, 1998, transferred to the Forest Service, we tried really hard to get that to go to the Park Service then. And we had major opposition from the hunt clubs because they were convinced you couldn't hunt in a national park. And we kept telling them, yes, you can. You make it a national park and preserve, and you can hunt in the preserve parts, and the rest of it is park. But we just couldn't get that done. 2 years ago, we got an amendment to the LBO Protection Act, several amendments actually, changed the LBO Protection Act to give it more protection. And we tried really hard then to get it to go to the National Park Service. And we thought we were going to get that through. And then we found out that several of the senators were opposed to that and wouldn't do it. They didn't, especially the senators from out west, did not want. We were going to put a limit on how much the Forest Service could cut every year. And the western senators were opposed to that because they said it would set a bad precedent to have limitations on how much you could cut. So we didn't get that through, but we got several other things, including the original Protection Act set up an advisory board. The advisory board had no teeth at all, met once a year, and basically it was a briefing. Forest Service would come in and tell you what they were doing. When we amended the Protection Act, we completely restructured that. It's going to meet several times a year, and it says the Forest Service shall consult with the advisory board on resource management. So they've got to run everything they're doing past the advisory board now. And we're really working with that to try to control what they're doing and how much. Land Between the Lakes, the area plan for the resource management plan is past due for revision. And one of my greatest fears is when they revise it, that they're going to try to eliminate those quarries. And we're going to be fighting really hard to protect those. I don't know of any place else that has those. I mean, over 42,000 acres that is supposed to be just left alone. Let nature manage it. And then you've got an ecological baseline to compare their management and see which did the better job. And they don't like that. That's why they don't want anybody going in and seeing those.
So with just a couple minutes left, can you tell people how they can find out more about the region and efforts to protect it?
The Between the Rivers group has a really active Facebook page with, last I checked, it was over 50,000 members on it. We keep everybody informed of that, what's going on. There's also several web pages now people have put up with information about Land Between the Lakes. The other thing is, if you show up here, look me up, and I'll give you a tour. I do that a lot, and I'm always proud to show people around over there.
So why don't we end with just a couple of your favorite non-human stories from the area, like I don't know, bears or interesting trees or interesting reptiles.
Well, we do have hellbenders over there, which is a ginormous salamander. I don't know if you've ever seen one of them or not, but they're pretty vicious looking, but they're really not. We do have elk and bison there now. Those have been reintroduced. There are no bears. We've got bald eagles everywhere over there. And then, of course, the usual collection of snakes from around here. It's not unusual at all when I'm over there poking around trying to get back into these quarries, running across rattlesnakes and copperheads. And most people don't realize it. A rattlesnake is really pretty timid. They don't want to mess with you. And if you leave them alone, they'll leave you alone. And copperheads will usually try to run from you, get away from you. We have several species of endangered and threatened plants, wildflowers. There are lots of those over there. Know if you've ever seen Rattlesnake Master. Rattlesnake Master plant, really unique looking plant. And it's not itself endangered or threatened, but it's the primary food source for a moth that is. So it gets protected too. I've been working with some of the botanists from down at Austin Peay that come up and do surveys trying to find the wildflowers and the botanicals and things. We have lots. We have more kinds of oaks and hickories over there, poplars, tulip poplars, beech, sycamores. I think TVA eliminated the last of the tupelos when they built Kentucky Lake. I don't know of any of those left. But and you get into the quarries. I guided. It was a team from National Geographic that was following the flyways for the spring migration. Started at the Gulf of Mexico and going all the way up to the head of the Mississippi River. And I guided them through Land Between the Lakes. Showed them where to go to find. They were recording songbirds, counting birds. And the guy told me with the recording equipment and everything that one of the places I took him, one of the quarries, he set up his recording equipment and said that was the longest recording he'd been able to make with no human sounds. And then an airplane flew over. Eventually an airplane. But in terms of birds, we've got pileated woodpeckers, scarlet tanagers. We have peregrine falcons over there now, along with the bald eagles. Unfortunately, cowbirds too.
Well, thank you for all that. And thank you for your work in the world. And thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank you. Oh, well, thank you. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been David Nickel. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.